no one knows how much money the state's going to be given away, and we don't know why or what for.
Complaints over the details of Alaska's new oil tax law. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a protest at an Anchorage Walmart over what's not in its freezer.
If a major purchaser like Walmart is no longer going to carry our product, that could seriously impact jobs in this state.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
After a bill gets signed into law, coming up with regulation to implement it is supposed to be the boring part. But when it comes to oil taxes, the way regulations are written could mean millions of dollars for either the state or for oil companies. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that both supporters and opponents of the recently passed tax overhaul aren't totally pleased with how the regulatory process is going.
One of the major goals of Governor Sean Parnell's tax package was to get new oil into the pipeline. On top of basically lowering the overall rate, the law that passed this spring also included a provision that would exempt 20% of new oil from taxes, period. Sounds like a sweet deal, right? Only, the oil industry isn't happy with how the state's trying to define new oil or measure it. Here's Michael Hurley, who handles government relations for ConocoPhillips.
The law was designed to provide a benefit for new oil going down the pipeline. And that is the goal of all of us. And to the extent that confusion and conflicting regulations cause a problem with that and make some things less economic or uneconomic, it's not satisfying that goal.
Hurley says the Department of Revenue's proposed regulations don't match the intent behind the new oil tax law.
Some of the rules we couldn't even comply with the way they're currently written.
Conoco's biggest concern is over what's known as metering in industry speak, basically figuring out just how much oil is coming out of the ground and going into production. State regulators want measurements to come from the wellhead, so you know you're not accidentally counting oil from spots that have already been in production, which would require producers to spend a lot of money on new equipment. Other producers also want the regulatory language changed.
It's really cumbersome. It's a really hard read.
That's Kara Moriarty, who represents the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. In a 20-page letter to the state, AOGA even asked if the regulations could be changed so producers can opt out of the new oil incentive altogether.
If the incentive is so hard and so expensive to achieve, it may not be a cost benefit to go through the process to determine whether it's new oil or not, or whether we just want it to be treated as legacy production.
In an interesting twist, it's not just the oil companies who are worried about how the state is defining new oil. A group of Democratic lawmakers who strongly opposed the new oil tax package when it made its way through the legislature this spring have called the regulations problematic in their own written testimony.
It is an irony.
Representative Beth Curtula of Juneau says that if the regulations are written too broadly, everything, even oil that's already being produced, could count as new. At current prices, that could mean a $7 tax break on every qualifying barrel. And that money stacks up. But as far as whether it adds up to millions, tens of millions, or more,
no one knows how much money the state's going to be given away. And we don't know why or what for, because we don't have this good definition of what really needs to be incentivized.
And she adds, if the definition's vague, the state could also face lawsuits on top of giving up revenue. Curtula says the problem isn't with the regulators. She has nice things to say about them doing what they can with the statutes they were given, something echoed by the oil industry. Curtula says the issue is with the underlying law. The final exemption for new oil was decided pretty late in the legislative process, and she says it wasn't defined narrowly enough.
I don't understand very well how people could have not seen this coming when again and again and again we put it out there and talked about it and said, why would you be giving these incentives when we're being unclear where they're going to be given, how it's going to work, and what's going to happen to the state?
So now, all of that is in the hands of regulators. The Department of Revenue couldn't comment on the public input they received on their rules as a policy, but Commissioner Bruce Tangeman says his agency is going through the input now. Later this fall, the Department of Law will also go over the regulations, and then the legislature will have a chance in the spring to review the rules and see if they match up with lawmakers' intent. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The ongoing eruption of the Vinnyaminov volcano on the Alaska Peninsula has increased in intensity in recent days, and a weak ash plume is being produced. KDLG's Mike Mason reports.
The Vinnyaminov volcano has been erupting since mid-June, but the level of eruptive activity has ticked upwards in recent days. John Power is the scientist in charge for the Alaska Volcano Observatory.
Really, since last Friday, we've had increased seismic activity characterized by what we call volcanic tremor, sort of a continuous shaking of the ground. We also, of course, see a little bit of increased lava coming out of the central cone of the volcano in satellite imagery. It's kind of kept us on our toes here at the observatory.
AVO confirms that a weak ash plume was visible Wednesday morning from the FAA webcam in Perryville. Power confirms the plume was rising several hundred feet above the volcano's cone, and the plume was drifting east.
It has not gotten up very high. There was, I believe, last Friday, a report of trace ashfall in Perryville, but we haven't had any other reports of it causing difficulties or problems for other folks at this point in time.
In an update issued Wednesday morning, the Alaska Volcano Observatory staff noted that ashfall from the current activity at the Vinnyaminov volcano is not expected to be significant and likely will be less than a 1/16 of an inch. Power says the activity being observed fits into the eruptive pattern of the volcano.
What we've seen is activity through this, through the 2013 eruption, kind of come up and, subside back down and come back up. This is not unlike what this particular volcano has done in the past, although the eruption now is getting to be a bit long-lived for Vinnyaminov. We've seen it erupt a number of times now, and this one seems to be lasting a little longer than, the previous eruptions, but still not unusual and still very characteristic of the types of activity we have seen in the past at this particular volcano.
The Vinnyaminov volcano is located on the Alaska Peninsula, about 480 miles southwest of Anchorage. It's one of the most active volcanoes in the state. It's erupted at least 13 times in the last 200 years. Images of the ongoing eruption and other information about the Vinnyaminov volcano can be found on the website of the Alaska Volcano Observatory at avo.alaska.edu. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an adventurous travel writer from Fairbanks talks about visiting war-ravaged countries.
It wouldn't look as dramatic as it seems talking about it, and it's not like, James Bond kind of stuff. It's nothing like that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Parents, encourage your kids to participate in the Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. It's free and a lot of fun. All your kids need to do is be active each week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes, too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating. And parents, why not get out and play every day with your kids? It's great for the whole family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Protesters converged on a Walmart in South Anchorage today to demand the megastore carry Alaska salmon. The protest comes on the eve of a big meeting between Walmart and state officials. The company doesn't carry frozen salmon labeled from Alaska because it doesn't meet their certification standard. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Inside the South Anchorage Walmart, there's no salmon labeled from Alaska in the freezer section.
Wild caught in Russia, processed in China, product of China, that's the skin on.
In the parking lot, Forrest Dunbar holds a big yellow sign.
Alaska salmon equal Alaska jobs.
The former fisherman from Cordova, who now lives in Anchorage, is protesting with about 50 other people. He says he's concerned that Walmart's stance that it will only carry salmon deemed sustainable by one third-party organization could hurt Alaskan fishermen.
Alaskan fishing fleet is one of the largest employers in the state. So if a major purchaser like Walmart is no longer willing to carry our product, that could seriously impact jobs in this state.
Since 2006, Walmart has required a third-party sustainability certification for its seafood. The Walmart in Anchorage is selling frozen salmon products with the Marine Stewardship Council sustainable certification label. The protesters are mostly fishermen or processors. Protest organizers like John Renner, vice president of Cordova District Fishermen United, say outside interests are trying to dictate market access. He contends that the MSC's main offices are located in Europe and that the agency charges too much for the certification.
10 years ago, MSC came to the state of Alaska and the industry groups and asked to certify Alaska salmon as sustainable. We looked at the issue, decided there wasn't any downside. A few people said, what if they raise their prices? What if they try to dictate management? What if they try to do this? We all said, well, we'll just deal with it when it happens.
Alaska salmon was one of the first major fisheries certified as sustainable by MSC in 2000. But Renner says costs started rising 5 years ago, along with demands from other agencies that are affiliated with MSC. So the major processors decided to drop MSC in favor of another third-party certification called Responsible Fisheries Management. Renner says Alaska salmon is already recognized around the world as the gold standard in responsibly and sustainably managed fisheries.
Sustainability is what we're all about here. We don't go fishing. We're on abundance-based management. We don't go fishing unless there is fish in the creeks, fish to reproduce for the next season. We don't want to catch the last fish. We're out of business if we do.
The protesters say given Alaska's record of sustainable fisheries management, Walmart should sell Alaska salmon. Sam Back, who says he buys fish at Walmart regularly, agrees.
If I continue to buy it, I'm going to want to pay attention to the packaging. And make sure it's coming from Alaskan waters instead of Russian waters.
Walmart is one of the largest grocery suppliers of salmon in the U.S. A spokesman for Walmart says the grocery chain is proud of what they've achieved in adopting the MSC certification, and they're considering carrying Alaska salmon. Senior Alaska officials are meeting with Walmart executives Thursday about the issue at Walmart's headquarters in Arkansas. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Some rainfall over the weekend may have eased a looming crisis for pink salmon stocks in southeast Alaska. The summer's fine weather and record salmon runs have both made headlines, but they're a recipe for trouble without enough water in rivers and streams for fish to spawn. KCAW's Robert Woolsey visited Sitka's Indian River to learn how the salmon were doing.
The Indian River is a mid-sized system. It drains a large valley to the east of Sitka, but there are no glaciers or permanent snowpack feeding it. I'm standing in the riverbed wearing running shoes. Didn't even occur to me to wear boots. The Indian River is low, and there are more fish in it than I've ever seen. We spook 200 or 300 pink salmon, and they surge away across the shallow gravels, leaving us standing among carcasses. I'm with Dave Gordon, the area management biologist for Fish and Game, and his tech, Jess Coltharp. A stream plugged with salmon is a good thing, but there is a problem. Gordon picks up a pink salmon and cuts it open.
Been dead a long time. There's another one. Yep. Just still in the skein. And obviously didn't die from spawning, died of stress there for some time. So based on that sample, I'd say a high percentage of the mortality you are seeing here is unspawned fish.
Gordon cuts open 5 dead females and all still have eggs, but he's not necessarily alarmed. For these salmon to have survived 2 years in the ocean and then come this far upstream only to die on the banks is not that unusual.
I think you always have a certain amount of stress mortality associated with the spawning event, so you are going to see pre-spawn fish die even in when the water is in better shape than it is here. But I certainly would think that the water quality in this case is definitely adding to the stress a lot and is probably causing a higher number to die before they have a chance to spawn.
Decaying fish rob the stream of oxygen. In a normal year, carcasses are flushed out to sea. Obviously, low rainfall is at the heart of the problem here, but are there also just too many fish?
This is an all-time record for Alaska. Right now, it's something above 250 million fish have returned.
Steve Reifenstuhl is the general manager of the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. In this job and in his previous position with a local processor, he's worked closely with the seine fleet, whose bread and butter is pink salmon. In Southeast, fishermen have taken nearly 90 million pinks.
We probably left at least 10 million, maybe 20 million pink salmon in the ocean that weren't needed for escapement that could have been harvested if there would have been sufficient process capacity.
But catching those fish, Reifenstuhl says, would have been unrealistic. The industry in Southeast can best handle about 70 million fish.
You know, you can't build infrastructure for a once-in-120-year event.
And less fish would have been a good thing at this stage, but there's a lot of systems that are much smaller than this, have much smaller watersheds, are much more dependent on the rainfall to have any water at all, and those are getting desperately low.
Dave Gordon thinks there are probably about three times as many fish in Sitka's Indian River than it can accommodate, and more are holding off the mouth in salt water, waiting for the stream to rise. But they can't hold forever. Enough will make it, though, to maintain this stock. Gordon thinks the system would be at risk of a crash only if dry weather persisted well into September. That's not a very big worry at the moment. Gordon, like any fisheries manager, is worried about taking my call next year.
I think what happens when people see this, and then next year we're going to get something more normal, and they're going to go, where's all the fish? You know.
Reporting on the banks of the Indian River in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
People who frequent the trails on the campus of the University of Alaska Fairbanks may have noticed lots of construction equipment all summer long. It's part of a project at the Alaska Satellite Facility. The facility is getting a new antenna this year. In coming years, it will collect data from NASA's polar orbiting satellites. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Men in hard hats and orange vests use a lift to reach the top of an enormous white satellite dish. It towers more than 65 feet above a popular trail system that's frequented by Fairbanks area runners, walkers, skiers, and bikers. An antenna sticks out like a thumb from the front of the huge dish. The men above string black wires through holes in the back.
Hooking up the trailer lights.
Alaska Satellite Facility Supervisor Wade Albright laughs as he tips his head back and looks up. He says it's like Christmas.
Oh yeah, absolutely. A new antenna is a very big deal.
There are two other antennas nearby. A large blue one was built on the roof of the university's Geophysical Institute back in the 1990s. A newer antenna stands only a few hundred feet down the trail from this brand new one.
It's been a long time since we've had a new antenna.
There are three stations like this in the state, but the Alaska Satellite Facility is the only one of its kind operated by a university. It's part of NASA's global network of stations that gather information about the Earth and its surroundings from satellites that pass overhead in low Earth orbit. It's called the Near Earth Network. Scott Arco is the facility's deputy director.
So it's not like Voyager and Pioneer that are going out to the edge of the solar system. We're not talking to them. We're talking to spacecraft that are orbiting the Earth relatively close to the Earth, but they're studying things all the way from the sun through the atmosphere down to the surface of the Earth.
Satellites circle the Earth roughly every 90 minutes. This new antenna will be able to track them for up to 15 minutes as they pass over Alaska. As they travel overhead, Arco says there's plenty of information the new antenna will download.
We have spacecraft that are looking out at the sun, measuring the physical properties of the sun, what's coming to Earth from the sun. We have spacecraft that are studying the atmosphere. They're looking through the atmosphere. They're looking at the auroras, that are looking at particulates and aerosols and things like that in the atmosphere. And then we have spacecraft that are looking at the surface of the Earth.
They collect all kinds of information, geology, soils, water, vegetation. Because this is a federally funded NASA project, that data is available to any scientist who wants to use it. But Arco says collecting data from a satellite doesn't come without challenges.
The problem is when a spacecraft is downlinking data from its place in orbit down to the Earth, a lot of times it's dumping a recorder that can never be rewound. And so if that data is lost between the spacecraft and the ground, it's never recovered. And so you may have some bit of information in there that was necessary or very important. And if it's not collected, it's gone.
A control room inside a nearby building houses the equipment required to gather data from satellites. And there's always someone present to make sure the antennas function properly. Wade Albright says two of the facility's three antennas can send commands to satellites as well.
So they can uplink to the satellites to change the telemetry, to change the orbits, to tell it to turn on.
Albright says the $7 million price tag for the new antenna is far less than the retrofits and upgrades the older antenna would require to do the same kinds of things. The new antenna is scheduled to be fully operational by December. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
A Fairbanks man has found adventure traveling and writing overseas. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Ernie Sipes grew up in Fairbanks and worked locally as a mental health counselor and substitute teacher until 2006 when he took a trip to the Congo in West Africa. Sipes, who likes to write and kayak, planned to do a story about paddling in the Civil War-plagued region, but after making contact with an official at the U.S. Embassy, he says the journey took a turn.
There were reports that there were rebel groups outside of the town of Mfondo, so he asked me to report on them, you know, give an estimate of who these people were, basically. I don't think anybody, it gets so few visitors, no one knows who those people really were.
Sipes says he observed the rebels while kayaking, later writing up what he saw for the U.S. Bureau of Information and Research. In another report for the State Department, he tracked what was happening on a Congolese railroad. He says General Motors was vying for a locomotive contract, and the U.S. government wanted to help them out.
Some of these embassies, the kind of backwater ones, aren't particularly well-funded, and they just want information to try to boost business on occasion. Plus a little competition between the Russian embassy, the Chinese embassy, and the American embassy.
Sipes says he rode the train documenting the cargo and riders on the line, which was often targeted by bandits. He shares photos of himself surrounded by armed men, but downplays the danger of his work.
It wouldn't look as dramatic as it seems talking about it, and it's not like, you know, James Bond kind of stuff. It's nothing like that.
Sipes says he also does occasional freelance pieces for newspapers. He recounts going to the Russian Republic of Georgia during a 2008 civil war.
Tbilisi was under siege. The only plane coming in was a Lufthansa flight. And me and one other man was in the back of the plane and some FBI guys in the front.
Sipes wrote a story for an English language newspaper whose own reporters claimed they were targeted by Russia.
Nina is the political writer. She told me she couldn't go because if they were killing reporters there. And she told me seven of her friends had been killed. If the Russians saw anyone with a camera, they'd just shoot at them.
Sipes says he ended up making it through the assignment safely, traveling with the Georgian Guard as Russian forces were pulling out. Sipes currently has a full-time job teaching English at a university in the Arab state of Oman. He's been visiting Fairbanks for a few weeks and is scheduled to head back to Oman later this month. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Talkeetna's honorary mayor is recuperating after a dog attack over the holiday weekend. Stubbs the cat gained worldwide notoriety last summer when his mayoral story went viral on a number of news agencies. He is currently recovering from surgery to repair a punctured lung, but has numerous other injuries that still need to be treated. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
While Stubbs is referred to as the mayor of Talkeetna, no such official position exists since the town is not incorporated. Still, the 16-year-old yellow cat is well-known and well-liked by locals and many visitors. He can often be seen lounging on a pile of furs at home in Nagley's store or visiting other businesses in town, especially the ones that will give him a snack or a comfortable place for a nap. It was on one of his usual walkabouts on Saturday that Stubbs was attacked by a local dog. Lori Stack, manager at Nagley, says that she received a call at home at about 10 p.m. on Saturday night informing her of the attack. She and a group of locals searched for the missing mayor for about an hour. Eventually, Lori went back to a place she had checked previously and called to Stubbs, who apparently recognized her voice and came out of his hiding spot. Lori and another Nagley's employee took Stubbs to the local vet to assess his injuries.
She looked at the wound, and it was probably about 4 or 5 inches long, and when she opened it up, you could see all the way into his insides. So she wrapped him up, took her euthanasia kit with her, because she didn't know if we would make it to the vet in time for Stubbs. So we ended up going to Big Lake because that was the closest vet that we could get to.
They did make it to Big Lake in time, and Stubbs was placed on life support before going into surgery for about 3 hours. His injuries are extensive and include a punctured lung and broken sternum. Though he was seriously wounded, Stubbs' prognosis is not as bad as it could have been.
He's holding his own. I mean, he's a tough old cat. But right now they're keeping him heavily sedated because these next 3 days is when he'll be in the most pain because his body's actually just starting to repair.
Talkeetna is a town where dogs are often seen running loose downtown. Most of the time, there are minimal issues, but this incident has some locals questioning the practice of allowing dogs to have the run of Main Street. Lori says she believes a lot of the responsibility lies with dog owners when something like this happens. She did not mention euthanizing the attacking dog, but says that some action is necessary.
I think that something should be done. I also know that he had a reputation and has a reputation, and I think that the owner should take a little more responsibility for it. He should have never been able to run loose. I think that maybe we should think about it and be a little more responsible for our pets. I have dogs. They don't come into town. So this is probably eye-opening for a lot of people. And I'm sure there's a lot of people that are going to be upset over it. But it is what it is. And it's Stubbs. Whether he's the honorary mayor or whatever, he's a pet. And he's well taken care of. And he's well loved.
The story of Stubbs' mauling has gone nationwide. And calls of support and messages and donations have started coming in on the Mayor Stubbs Facebook page. For now, Talkeetna's honorary mayor will remain at the animal hospital in Big Lake as his treatment continues. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.